So good evening and afternoon, as the case may be, and welcome to NARSL in Action. This evening we're going to have a different format, as hopefully those of you who read the email and are already listening in know that we're going to have several people speaking tonight. And this conference call is going to focus on the legislation around the state, the various states dealing with the statute of limitations to either eliminate or to dramatically alter the statute of limitations. We're also going to hopefully talk about some other bad bills that are pending, and we're going to look for common themes of what's pending around the country. And I have a hidden agenda here. I want to, hopefully at the end of this call, we get a more formal working relationship on legislative advocacy of networking and working together in a collaboration. We have our affiliates list, and there's a lot of exchange in email format on the affiliates list, but we really don't have a team collaboration. And there's a lot of commonality in terms of what's pending around the country. Lawmakers don't just sit around and think this stuff up. Very seldom. Usually the bills that are pending, they've been presented by an advocacy group of some type or another, be it the District Attorneys Association, be it some group that advocates for victims' rights. But there's common bills pending around the country. And it would be ideal if we could work together and figure out strategies and talking points, and we could rather than having each advocate or each group trying to figure out how to undertake these battles themselves. There will be things that I do in advocacy that I would never, ever put in an email. So I know it's the most efficient form of communication, but it's just not appropriate for parts of legislative advocacy. There are things that I do and things that I know how to do that I would never put in writing in an email, because it just wouldn't be appropriate. It would be misunderstood if that email got forwarded or got out. So I will try to help people a lot, but I will help you by talking to you. I will not put things in emails that are sensitive. So hopefully you guys understand that emails are great, the listserv is great, but actually working in a team collaboration model where we actually talk and do some face-to-face time through whatever they call that, where you do where you actually can see each other. But I'm hoping that at the end of this call that we can start moving towards having a NARSL legislative collaboration. So we've got all these bills that you've seen in the emails that deal with the statute of limitations. And I appreciate all the states that provided these to us. I appreciate Hank for providing me the first list. And I'm sorry if I missed anybody who sent an email who told me about one that didn't go on the list. But the list is significant, regardless of whether it's complete, that you get the picture. So I'm gonna start by talking to Ms. Barbara Gale. And right now it's going to be Barbara and I, we're going to have a chit-chat, and we're going to talk about common questions that we've received already that we're going to try to answer about why the statute of limitations exist. In fact, I got an email this afternoon right before the call from Illinois saying that giving me some excerpts of a conversation with the Attorney General about why that they should be taking the actions they're taking on the why the statute of limitations is so bad. So welcome, Barbara Gale,
hello.
Attorney from Georgia, my favorite attorney from
I'm glad to hear that.
So the attorney that I can call on the spur of the moment without preparation and throw her into the fire and tell her just to figure it out, and she always comes through for me. So I've done that again on this. I've told her to get prepared to be quizzed about the statute of limitations, and she said, "What are you going to ask me?" And I said, "Well, just be ready."
To get my toes singed.
So Barbara, tell us a little bit about the statute of limitations. What does it do? What does it mean when we see that SOL? You and I know it, but there's people on here who it would help to kind of explain what the statute of limitations is.
Well, a statute of limitation basically sets a time limit for either prosecutors in a criminal case or plaintiffs in a civil case to file an action. the most common thing that people are probably aware of is like a car accident. And each state has a statute of limitations. Many of them it's 2, sometimes it's 3 years. And what that means is that if you're going to file a claim with me because I ran into you and you had neck pain and back pain, you can't wait forever. You have to do that within that 2 or 3 years that's set by statute. Now, since it says statute, and again, that's not statute for people that get it confused, it's something, it's a law that is set by the legislature, either of the each state or by the federal government, that defines the amount of time that you have to file an action. In a criminal action, it means that the prosecutor, the district attorney, cannot file a claim against you if that period of time has expired. There are some exceptions, murder being one. If any of you watch 2020 and Dateline and all those things like I do, you know that they can keep looking for someone who's committed murder forever until they find them. General crimes, misdemeanors, usually it's 12 months. Some states it's up to 5 years in Alaska. There's a wonderful tool that I found today that has them all listed. And if you go online and just look for statute of limitations in your state, you can find those. But it sets up a time frame within which the prosecution has to act. At our Texas conference, we had William Quinn, who's an attorney from Georgia, who said that when he started practicing law, the statute of limitations for murder was 7 years. Well, now there's none. It's been expanded. And other things, usually like armed robbery, you're looking at 10 years. Drug cases, it all depends. There are all these little limitations. But it's really important.
So it varies with the nature of the criminal allegation is what you're saying.
It varies with the severity of the crime or in a civil case with the type of civil case it is. There's one thing that's particularly interesting that I need to point out, that if, for instance, in a civil case, and that's where you're bringing a claim for damages against another person who has harmed you, there's and particularly to us, victims can bring civil cases against their perpetrators, and the statute of limitations is extended for minors, because they are suffering what they call a disability. It's not that they're disabled, but they're suffering under a legal disability, which means that 15, 16, 17-year-olds don't know the law, they're not aware of it, and so most states have a tolling, it's called, of the statute of limitations until they reach their majority, which in most states is age 18. So then the statute starts to run once they have reached the age of 18. Anyway, you go ahead and ask me the question. That's my little general spiel there.
I appreciate that, Barbara. I'm not going to ask a lot of questions because we've got a lot of reports. I'm going to really focus on one more, and that's I received more than one email about how can these legislators just abolish the statute of limitations? Isn't that against the Constitution?
Well, it's not a constitutional law. I mean, it's a statute, which means that legislators decided this was important. And this is something that goes back to the common law, which goes back to England, which goes back, years and years, hundreds of years, because courts found that it's crazy to try to come up with something that happened to you 20 years ago and say, you know what? He came over and he broke down my fence 20 years ago, and I want him to fix it. Well, the fence has long since been gone, and there's an interstate highway there, and so they build these statutes of limitations in to say we don't want to have to deal with stale claims. The claim still has to be fresh enough that there are witnesses, that there is actual evidence, that either the prosecutor is going to be able to find sufficient evidence to support a claim, or the defendant is going to be able to have access to evidence to defend him or herself.
Would it be fair to say that cases, as they get older, that they deteriorate significantly in terms of the quality of the case you can put on, and if we're requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt, evidence that would mitigate your damage with your vulnerability to a conviction, your witnesses may be dead. They may not be locatable. I mean, can you expand on the
sure.
What happens as a case ages?
As the case ages, of course, witnesses can disappear or die. With actual scientific evidence, and I don't even want to get into DNA because that's a whole other conversation, but things get stale, and as they get stale, they're harder to read. They're harder to understand. And the other thing is think about the IRS, okay? And the IRS says that you have to maintain your documents for how many years because you might have an audit. As an attorney, I'm required to maintain files for at least 7 years for IRS claims, whatever. So let's say that this happened 10 years ago, and nobody has access to bank records or telephone records or anything that they could use in their support, because we cannot hang on to these things forever. Believe me, as an attorney, I'm constantly going through files and purging them, because you can't hold on to everything you've ever done. Companies, traditionally, 5 years. You go to the bank and you say, I want to look at my bank statement from 1988. They are going to laugh in your face because that does not exist. They have trimmed their files. They have gotten rid of it. And sure, there may be some place that has it. But traditionally, companies, businesses do not maintain records for more than 5 years. So how do you defend yourself? I could not have committed that crime because I was in Los Angeles and I had a hotel room and I went to dinner at such and such a place. Nobody has those records anymore. So the longer the time that passes, the more those kinds of actual pieces of evidence go away. And memories, okay? If you have eyewitness identification, which is it's just not reliable. It's totally unreliable. My son and I were almost mugged 3 weeks ago. I thought it was a black man. He thought it was a white man. And we were both in the same place at the same time. So if you let the passage of time go, it's impossible to remember. And the other thing, and this is something I was commenting to someone earlier today, is that in a criminal situation, the jury already assumes that you must have done something or you wouldn't be in court. This thing about you're presumed innocent until proven guilty is like hen's teeth. You know, you find it very rarely. Most of the time, juries are going to assume that if the prosecution has gone to the trouble of bringing you here, you must have done something. And if you are not able to build your own defense because it's been 10, 12, 20 years, then you're going to have more and more convictions of people who are innocent.
So, I think that gets through my basic questions, Barbara.
Good.
I'm going to plug the national conference here. Before we go to the state reports, our conference web page is a little bit sparse right now. Would you say that would be fair, Brenda?
don't
have a lot on it. But what we do have is the hotel this year. We're going to have probably more difficulty for last minute reservations because our event is scheduled around a time where they have a lot of activity with reunions, and we pick the time when they're very busy. So of our block of rooms, a third of them have already been reserved for the conference. So I'm going to encourage people that if you are reasonably sure you're going to come to the conference, to go ahead and go follow that link, and it'll populate the information with our code, our group code, and go ahead and book your room. There's no charge. And then if you need to cancel, if you decide you're not going, you can release your room later, because waiting till the last minute may not serve you well, A, because the block releases 3 weeks before the conference if there are any rooms left, and B, if the block gets full, we may not be able to get them to add rooms this year like we did last year. We kept adding rooms last year because we kept having more and more people adding in, so we went well over our block. But so in terms of the details about the conference, we don't have a lot more to add, but hopefully early next week we'll have more to announce in terms of who some of the important key speakers will be, and the workshop information will start going up hopefully shortly thereafter. But it's June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Is that correct, Brenda?
That's it. And then if you want to get in a little bit, the first meet and greet the Thursday before, we have a meet and greet that night for those who are early birds and get in early enough to meet and mingle.
So that'd be Thursday night. Then the conference kicks off Friday, all day Saturday, and then we'll end it around noon on Sunday, and we'll have our celebratory banquet on Friday night, because there again they have the need for their facilities for a reunion on Saturday night, so we had to move our banquet to Friday night. So let's go to the state reports. Everybody who raised your virtual hand in the first round, we're going to go to you now. So go ahead and raise your hand, get in the queue.
They're in the queue, Larry. They're still waiting for you.
Okay, so we're going to ask you to keep your reports fairly brief and tell us about your statute of limitations bill. About what makes is it a total abolition? What's unique about it, or does it start tolling? Is it tolling until they're 21 or 18 years old, and then they have so many years after that? Does it apply just to civil or criminal or both? Like in our state, we have one dealing with both. In New Mexico, I didn't put both of them on there, but we actually have both. But yeah, and tell us what's going on in your state, and try to keep your report, since there's so many, to 3 to 4 minutes, please. So you can go ahead, and we can take the first caller.
Okay, Don, you're on.
Yeah, I'll be kind of quick, because I know our bill isn't anywhere near as egregious as some of these other states. But in South Carolina, it's worth noting that on the criminal side, there is no statute of limitations on any felony. So there isn't any such thing, and that's been in existence for a long time. Generally, it's 3 years for civil cases, except that for sex offenses in particular, what Barbara mentioned is true with juvenile victims. It tolls until they're 21, and then they have 6 years, so they actually have until they're 27. If they were abused as a juvenile, they have until they're 27 to file suit. But what the bill is this year is, it was unexpected from my standpoint. They're actually trying to toll the statute of limitations. And this isn't specifically sex offenses, but on any kind of criminal offense that goes on, the civil statute of limitations is tolled until the perpetrator has completely finished his or her sentence, whether it's prison or probation or parole or anything. The 3 year statute of limitations does not begin under this bill until they have completely finished their penal obligation to the state.
So we'll start counting after you've served your 20 years.
That's right. And one side of me says, well, maybe one part of this isn't so bad, because it's extremely difficult to defend yourself in a lawsuit when you're incarcerated. And so I almost felt like if you're actually in prison, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Well,
wait till you're out of prison, so you're actually on the street. You can talk to attorneys. You can do stuff.
Don, yeah. I think you might be reading too much into that. It doesn't say that it must be filed. It says that it can't be filed until you're out. It says the way you're describing it, you don't start counting.
They can file it. But my point is that it may give you an additional window.
If if wouldn't they be able to file while you're in prison anyway?
They can if they want to.
Okay. Just
but I would. I mean, if I were on the receiving end of that lawsuit, I would rather they waited.
Okay.
I don't want to try to defend myself in a lawsuit while I'm
point.
In prison.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Been there, done that once. Had to show up in a courtroom in my SCDC jumpsuit and shackles, and nobody's going to take you seriously.
But that's
the favorable side of it. I have a problem with them waiting on probation and parole because that may drag out for years and years when you're actually on the street. And that it almost negates the purpose of having the statute of limitations to start with. So my take on the bill is, maybe the right compromise is let them toll it till you get out of prison, but let's get rid of the language that includes probation and parole. But we'll see where it comes down. But it's in a big victims crime bill that's now been, just as of the last day or two, has showed up in the Senate too, so it's coming in both chambers. And in some form, the bill is going to pass. It's almost guaranteed.
So thank you, Don.
Okay, ready for our next one?
We're ready.
Okay, I believe that will be Scott.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, well, I miscounted. We actually have 5 bills that eliminate statute of limitations this legislative session. So I'll remind you where this all came from. Last April, Dennis Hastert, who's from Illinois, was sentenced. Dennis Hastert. He stated at the sentencing hearing, he admitted that he had sexually abused boys who he coached. And as I won't review that case any further, but last April, I think it was after the sentencing hearing, later in the month, our Attorney General Lisa Madigan put out a press release saying that she was going to be pushing for elimination of statute of limitations, blah, blah, blah. News stories came out, TV news, newspapers reporting that this is coming about because of the Dennis Hastert case. And, oh, by the way, there's a group called SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. SNAP is pushing for elimination of the statute of limitations for obvious reasons. And then there's also a victims advocacy group in Illinois that's also pushing it, apparently, because they also appeared with Lisa Madigan when she did her press conference. There was actually a Senate criminal law hearing on this topic last October. I listened to it, but I don't have a lot of notes. I seem to recall there were legitimate concerns voiced at the hearing. There was a bill, I believe, at the time. There was a bill that under consideration, but I think they just let it go. They knew it was going to be dealt with in this year's session. So 5 bills are filed. There's 2 that didn't make our list. They were House Bill 716 and 744. Briefly, 716 eliminates the statute of limitations for sexual assault or sexual abuse against a minor, regardless of whether corroborating physical evidence is available. Currently, you have to have corroborating physical evidence, and the statute of limitations goes out till the minor reaches age of 38. That extension was done several years ago, I believe. I think it used to be shorter than that, but now you have until age 38 to make a claim to say there was sexual assault or sexual abuse. House Bill 744 adds a whole bunch of other offenses, including solicitation to meet a child, child pornography, posting of, the list goes on and on, traveling to meet a minor. It adds all of those offenses to the list.
They're adding the nonviolent offenses where you haven't even actually had any contact, and assuming that go ahead, keep going.
That's right, and I don't know currently what the statute of limitations is for those offenses. And then House Bill 2435 similarly eliminates, it's pretty much the same bill. And then there's one on the Senate side, And then House Bill 3849 eliminates for a number of other offenses, including involuntary servitude, involuntary sexual servitude of a minor, trafficking in of persons, indecent solicitation of a child, indecent solicitation of an adult, sexual exploitation of a child, permitting sexual abuse of a child. One of the bills also adds in the offense of, you know, like if you were a mandated reporter and you didn't, you knew about something, there was an alleged abuse that occurred, but you didn't report it, that's also a crime. And they want to eliminate the statute of limitations for that because apparently, I guess there were people that knew about Dennis Hastert and they didn't report it. So that's the list. Now, the last thing I wanted to say is that, well, we have 28 bills that we're tracking this session, and they're all listed on our website. You can just go on there and click on legislative current session, and you'll see this whole Google Doc show up on your screen on our website.
You have a marvelous tracking tool.
Oh, thanks. We just embed a Google Doc. So it's I maintain with another board member, we maintain the Google Doc, and then it's just automatically links to our webpage. I don't know how – there's a way to do that. If someone needs help, I can get you in touch with the person that knows how to do that. But I update the Google Doc, and immediately you see it on our webpage.
Sounds like magic to me.
It is. So I actually just wanted to comment that Illinois Voices – We don't take a position on bills that involve sentencing or prosecution for various reasons. I mean, it's not a really a good thing to take a position on. I guess I mean as an organization that's trying to advocate for change for people who've done their time, we just don't put our energies into that. So we actually have a short list of bills that we oppose. I think there's six bills that we oppose. They have to do with restrictions and registration that are, you know, increased rules and restrictions that people face. There's a number of bills that we support this session. There's only five. And then the rest of the bills are all ones that are indicated no position, but they're all.
I noticed that you have no position on a lot of bills that are on your tracking table.
Yeah, they're all sentencing and prosecution related. I mean, they're trying to make it easier to, put people on the registry for battery. You know, even though if the offense was sexually motivated, hey, there's a reason why the prosecutor decided to pursue a battery charge and not a sexual offense charge. So anyway, there's already been a hearing on that last year, and we'll see if that bill goes anywhere this year. But yeah, we don't. There's too many bills to take a position on. One last thing. We do find out if there's a bill that we oppose. Along with tracking all of these bills, we if we get word that a bill is going to a hearing. If it's one that we oppose, we will make sure that our supporters are told about it through an email, and we ask them to file witness slips, which is done on the internet, and we fill up the where the legislature keeps track of witness slips. We fill it up with opposition. We will send someone to a hearing if we know that a bill is coming up for a hearing. We typically call, we make phone calls to staffers of the either the bill sponsor or the head of the committee that the bill is being heard in to check whether a bill is going to be heard, because we've shown up to committee hearings in the past only to learn that a bill is not being called. So it's not worth our effort to travel to Springfield unless we know
those,
for sure.
Those are the type of things that's helpful for advocates if we get our collaborative going to learn those details and to learn how. I mean, your tracking table is more extensive than ours, but that's what I'm trying to build here, is this type of collaboration. Appreciate your report, Scott.
Oh, sure.
So who's next?
Hi, this is Hank from Nebraska.
Hank, thank you for helping me get started on this with your initial research.
Yeah. You got it rolling. Tomorrow we're up, and our bill is pretty benign. It's called LB 300, but it eliminates the statutes of limitations on civil suits. nothing to do with criminal. And it's
You're fading out, Hank. Can you repeat what you just said, the last sentence?
Sure, hang on. Okay, it'd be better the way I'm talking now.
Okay.
Basically, our bill is eliminating the statutes of limitations completely, just on the civil side. It is a proactive bill. Its intent is proactive, not retroactive.
Do you mean prospective, Hank?
Yes.
Okay, just clarifying.
I said proactive. I'm in training.
Okay.
Yeah, it's prospective, not retroactive. So we're not going to fight it a great deal because of that issue. We don't see it as greatly harmful. A couple of weeks ago, we had a much bigger battle, but I'm not going to go into that. I just want to stay on the SOL business here. We do have help. Derek Logue has done a 4-page report, which we are presenting. The hearing for our bill is tomorrow afternoon. Ironically, we had a snowstorm coming. We'll see. Derek has done a 4-page research report that I don't know if he'll be releasing it to other states, but I suspect he will. It's a brand new report, and it's going to be on this business of the true story of false memory. He develops that whole thing where memories get lost, they fade, our brains are not computers, human memory is notorious, unreliable. I believe he'll make that available for any of you that want to use that as part of your opposition, but you have to check with Derek on once fallen. I'm not allowed to release it. But I will be using it tomorrow.
Hank, can I ask you a question? And I don't know if you know the answer. When you say prospective, do you mean that the statute of limitations, the abolition, will be for incidents that occur after the enactment, or do you mean that if the current statute of limitations hasn't run, that the new statute of limitations would apply? When you say proactive, can you clarify, or have you been able to ascertain what you mean by prospective?
Yeah, it kind of goes along with the Stogner decision in California, where with the criminal end, it's the time of the crime. So what we have here is if somebody commits a crime after the date of this elimination of statute of limitations, that's where it applies.
Okay. So it would be for new occurrences, not anything that's in the past.
Yes.
Okay.
We had to do a lot of research to find out their intentions, but we actually got confirmation today from a number of sources, so we're doing good there.
So
there's not much else to say, and I know other people want to get on the line, so I think I should hop off. That's pretty much it.
Well, thank you, Hank. And who's next?
Richard.
Yeah, Brenda. Actually, I probably don't have anything to add onto this conversation specifically from New Hampshire. The other things going on in New Hampshire have nothing to do with statute of limitations.
So do you want to hop back in later when we go to open?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Ditto for me. For Arkansas, we don't have any statute of limitations going on either, so I want on the next group.
Okay. Thank you, Carla. It looks like that the number in the queue is shrinking now to only a couple more.
With Carla, we actually are moving into the other queue with the questions, so I don't know if you want to go ahead and make your shift, if that's where we're at.
Well, what I want to do, since we're doing fairly well on time, is I want to go into some general discussion with the callers that are we've got quite a crowd here, so we will take some questions, but probably about 30 minutes worth, and then we'll go to the other report. Remember my goal is I'm trying to build a working collaborative of NARSL people, so that we're not fighting these battles alone when we have a common battle to fight, like statute of limitations. So let's take a few questions, 20 minutes or so, up to 30 minutes of questions about the statute of limitations. So the six, if it's not too much trouble, we can skip the next two, go ahead and clear Carla from the queue, and then we can let people load up again with questions about statute of limitations.
Including the other two people that were there with
Well, yeah, is it possible just to go ahead and jump past them?
What I'll do is I'm going to clear the queue. I've jotted these other two folks' names down.
Okay.
You can hop back up at the right time. I don't have names.
Okay, I see that there's – okay.
And,
so
yeah,
queue.
So if you want to move ahead to more open questions
about
statute
of limitations for this round of questions. And if you have another comment you want to make, ask that you hold it till later. But we're trying to enlarge the information and understanding about statute of limitations and why this is so important. If you've ever been suspected of a crime and they abolish the statute of limitations, you're in jeopardy on the criminal side. If you've ever been convicted of a crime and they abolish the civil statute of limitations, and it's not prospective, you're in jeopardy. They can come back for you, and that's what this is all about. If people saw 60 Minutes Sunday night, there was one of the most prestigious gymnastics schools in America apparently had some misconduct that spanned a period of 20 years by the physician, and he's now, I think, in custody in Michigan pending charges. So the Hastert high-profile case, the gymnastics, there's so much pressure on lawmakers to make these changes, and there's very little opposition. It's difficult to go in to the legislatures and oppose these bills. I mean, you get booed off of the stage when you do show up. So Brenda was just recently in her legislature, and I don't know if you got booed off the stage, but Was it a pleasant experience?
No, it's a really tough experience, frankly, to testify on these, because you do have so many really pretty terrible. There's always plenty of stories, and they bring out past victims and that sort of thing. It can be really, really hard. I didn't take the opportunity when you were asking the other people through questions, but yeah, in Maryland, we also long since lost all criminal statutes of limitations a long time ago, but they do have a bill this year that's trying to increase the civil ones. So just what you were describing, so you could have committed a crime, at some point in fairly distant past. If this bill passes, it's going from 7 years to 20 years after the date that the person reaches majority, so they could be 38, and that's what they're changing it to. And you could have done your time, and paid your debt to society, and then that person could still come back and sue you for everything you managed to have, been worth between then and now. To find out that you're actually doing okay for yourself, So that's what this bill is, our new bill is about.
So, well, I only see one question, so I guess everybody has been satiated with answers already. So let's take the question from...
All right. We do get another question that came in, so we'll see. So, James?
Oh, yeah, hello, thanks. This is Jimmy. I was curious because it even came up in group this morning, a little bit about what we're talking. I'm calling from Missouri, and we've got multiple bills. And there are some of the bills that are being proposed that are referencing the statute of limitations, but I haven't completely read through them because I'm not on the legislative committee that's going out to Jeff City. I'm not even allowed to go out to travel that far. So I'm not able to do that. The question I have is, for those of us that are on lifetime supervision that have been compelled for compliance for our therapy purposes to take sexual history polygraphs, and someone has disclosed something in their history, and it could have been for more than 20 years ago, but it doesn't matter, they now have a written, documented, video-recorded what they could use as a so-called confession against you, and that is a concern that a lot of the guys have in group, where we're told we have to take these polygraphs, and this is stuff that happened before some of these cases came up, like in Colorado where the guy challenged it. if you already have taken the test and they now have it on a file in their file cabinets, they're not throwing that away, and they're still hanging it over your head. And you have to worry, and this is what we were talking about in group, all the time with this sword hanging over your head. Are they going to come after me for this later? I mean, there's no guarantee they're not, and all the therapist can tell you is you're in a bad spot.
And, James, that's all we can really tell you as well. The case law, and Barbara can feel free to go ahead and chime in, but the case law is in its infancy on this on these issues regarding the self-incrimination and what they can do with that information that they've collected. Of course, if you were to be sued and you were to be able to afford an attorney, you would challenge the admissibility of that, and you would say it was under compulsion that you provided that statement. But Barbara, would that type of objection fly?
You know, that's a tough spot. You know, we have the case in Georgia where the court in Atlanta held that the lady didn't have to answer those questions. But once you've already answered them, you know, that's closing the barn door after the horse has already left the building. I think that there would be a good argument that it was compelled speech, and there is a protection where there's compelled speech.
So that's as good of an answer as we can give you. But those would be things that would be raised by legislative advocates. That when you're trying to think of arguments, so you've raised it, something that I hadn't even thought of as an argument that we can use for our collaborative, because we would go in and testify and say, whoa, here's the problem with this.
Right.
You know, you're going to undermine treatment. You're going to have people who are not going to get better because they're going to be worried about opening themselves up to potential liability on the civil side.
Mm-hmm. Our future criminal.
Future criminal actions, exactly.
So, yeah, future criminal act, yeah.
So, that's why we need this collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, do you want to take a couple more questions,
yes,
Larry? We have a couple more come in.
We've got a couple more. Thanks, James.
Thank you. Cheryl?
Hi, this is Cheryl in Missouri, but I move around a lot. I've been in Oregon, South Dakota, Kansas, Colorado, so I've got a son in prison in Iowa and another son in prison in Colorado, so I'm all over the map. So here's my question. Does a suit against somebody have to be filed in the state in which the offense allegedly occurred?
No.
Really?
It's where the defendant resides, generally. A civil lawsuit is filed where the defendant resides, or if an action occurred in a particular place there, or if it involves property in a certain place, that state. But generally speaking, there are a few exceptions. Generally, it's filed where the person resides.
Where the plaintiff resides or the defendant resides?
Defendant.
Okay.
So, Barbara, doesn't that get into the issue of jurisdiction and whether you
yes.
the issue of subject matter and personal jurisdiction?
Yes.
And you can briefly, if a lawyer can do something, briefly explain the difference in subject matter and personal jurisdiction.
Personal jurisdiction is to have jurisdiction over the individual, and the state of Georgia, for example, which is where I am, cannot force a citizen of Missouri to come to Georgia, unless mm-hmm. it's a car accident. There's some of those exceptions. But if a person is within the jurisdiction of the state, you're in the jurisdiction of Georgia. Georgia has jurisdiction over you. There are things called long arm statutes, and that's for something like a car accident. You came to Georgia. You were on vacation. You ran into somebody. You went back to Missouri. That's a different kind of a thing. Subject matter jurisdiction is that each court has limited subject matter jurisdiction. The superior courts in Georgia, which are our highest level of entry in, you know, into certain litigation, we have, of course, inferior courts, which are called like probate courts and juvenile court. But superior court is where trials are held, where civil actions are filed. They have jurisdiction over certain matters, and they don't have subject matter jurisdiction over things that happen in other states. There's limited jurisdiction. For example, in Georgia, we have state courts, and they can handle certain types of crimes and certain kinds of civil actions, but the Superior Court is our general court of jurisdiction. Other states have things like circuit courts. I know, I think it's New York, that their Superior Court is the equivalent of our Supreme Court. But whatever the initial trial court is, that's where that kind of a lawsuit would be filed.
Well, Barbara, can we just clarify? I think that she's primarily focused on the civil side, but in a criminal case, you could you not have jurisdiction over a person who committed a crime and they're in another state? There's a mechanism to compel appearance.
That's the long arm of the law, yes.
So, okay.
A person who's committed a crime, you can go after wherever they are, and there are all kinds of interstate compacts between states which allow the state of Georgia to call up Missouri and say, hey, you know, we have a warrant against, you know, John Doe, and can you help us? And then there are things called extradition and all that kind of thing. But when you're talking about filing a lawsuit, if Jane Doe, who lives in Georgia, wants to sue John, who molested her in 2010, and he's now in Missouri, she has to sue him in Missouri, pretty much, unless you fit into some of those exceptions.
Now, there's one other exception that I'll throw out there, is that you when it comes to jurisdiction, subject matter can't be stipulated to, meaning the parties cannot agree if their subject matter. But on personal jurisdiction, if a person in another state wants to submit themselves to the jurisdiction of a court out of state, they can do that.
They
don't have to raise the objection to personal jurisdiction. They can show up in Georgia and say, I'll answer this complaint, but you don't have to.
Exactly.
So
you can ignore it.
So does that help, Cheryl?
Thank you for that very complicated answer. I don't know if I could ever regurgitate that back out to another person.
Well, and I'm sorry, because it's not easy. You know, that's why law school is 3 years. You know, it's not easy to say, well, this is the way it is, because that's the way it is unless. And you always have to look at those unlesses, because those unlesses make a lot of changes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I guess you could also add in, well, that's the way it is here in Georgia, but it's a little different up there in New York, and then we got these exceptions over in Missouri.
Right.
And,
every state has their own statutes, but generally speaking, you know, that's kind of the way it works.
Okay, so let me give you may I ask one more question, please?
Briefly, yes.
Okay. So let's say I have a woman who's now in her mid-20s, who was molested by her 12-year-old cousin when she was 5 and he was 12. And she decides that she wants to dredge this all up and sue this cousin and get some money. Is that likely to be honored by a court?
You get into things called disabilities, and it doesn't mean, you know, somebody who has been determined by the Social Security Administration to be disabled. A minor suffers under the disability of being a minor. That's, you know, being underage. The laws on that are going to be ruled state by state, but generally speaking, I would not think that she would be successful suing someone who was 12 at the time. Larry?
That would be my take, but boy, that's a tough one, because that's what things are about. They shouldn't get away with it. They did it, and it was wrong, and they shouldn't get away with it. And the victims were putting on powerful testimony about what happened to them all these decades ago. And when I'm at a hearing, at the end of the hearing, when they say all those opposed to the bill, there's not a soul there. And after you've had all that emotional testimony, it's just very tough on these lawmakers to say, well, you know, we're going to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Well, it's tough. So I wouldn't say that I would agree with Barbara that it's going to be, it's going to be a tough case, but I wouldn't say it's impossible.
The thing that happens is that you have lawyers who will sue over nothing under, you know, with the potential that they might be successful. And I'm sorry to say that as a member of the bar, but But there are those who, you know, who would sue a snake for having bitten somebody. But, you know, I hope that that's not your situation.
Well, thanks, Cheryl. We certainly did not get reports from all the states who are on the list, and those of you who didn't see the full list, we've had similar legislation in Indiana, Oklahoma, New Jersey, New York, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, Vermont, and Washington. And Washington State is on here, but I haven't heard a peep from Washington. Washington, do you want to speak? But we've got a plethora of these abolition of statute limitations in various forms, either extending them from the time they're 18 to 20 years later, total abolition, and it's a trend that we're going to have a hard time fighting. NARSL is willing to partner with any organization, with any group that wants to work together with us to try to bring some sanity to this. Because there needs to be some pushback, and so I'm hoping that of the callers on here and the people that are working that we can form a group on this issue and maybe some other issues as well. So I see Don is in here, and then we can ask for other general comments and questions because the queue is empty.
Yeah, I know this applies more applies to criminal cases as opposed to civil ones, and most of the conversation's been about civil cases. But can somebody address the ex post facto considerations where a crime is committed in 1985 and the statute of limitations is 10 years then, and then they come back 20 years later and abolish the statute of limitations? Doesn't the ex post facto clause keep them from reaching back if there was a statute of limitations at the time the crime was committed?
That's a very good question.
It is.
You could put that on a law exam, law school exam.
leave it to Don to come up with that. What has happened?
I thought there was actually a case in California a couple of years ago that dealt with this question, but I just don't remember the ins and outs of what the deal now.
The outcomes that I'm familiar with is if the statute of limitations has already run prior to the change, the courts are saying you're out of time. But if the statute hasn't run and they change it, then you're subject to the additional time. You're not grandfathered into the 10-year if they change it to 30 years, if the 10 years hasn't run. But if the 10 years has run, the case law that I'm aware of says you don't get to reset the clock and say, gee, you didn't exhaust the statute of limitations. So, and we'll welcome any contradictory, if people have case law that's contradictory to that, but that's I'm not aware of any contradicting that.
And it sucks, okay?
I wouldn't see that, Don, as an ex post facto claim necessarily, because the ex post facto deals with changing the penalty that was available. If it was already against the law, the penalty that was available at that time would be what they would be constrained to imposing on you. So the statute of limitations, if it wasn't against the law at the time, then that's where your ex post facto analysis takes place. If there's a criminal act, you need notice at the time that it was a crime and what the penalties were that were available. So I don't see that this would be a good ex post facto argument here, because the penalty that was available at that time would be the penalty that was available still today.
Well, no, the penalty is only valid for 10 years, though, if that's what the statute of limitations is. By extending the statute of limitations, you have effectively increased the penalty.
Well, wouldn't the penalty still be a maximum of whatever the penalty was? That's what
if you're caught within 10 years.
Yeah, but see, that's what the ex post facto analysis says, that you can't change the penalty by increasing the penalty. You can change it downward, but you can't increase the penalty or create a penalty for a crime that wasn't a penalty. So that
I hear what you're saying, but it wouldn't stop me from arguing the point.
Wait a minute. I think I hear what Larry is saying. I mean, if you could only be sentenced to a maximum of 5 years 10 years ago, but then they went and changed the statute of limitations, and 30 years from now somebody comes back and says, I'm suing, you for, you know, for this crime. You know,
well, now we're talking about criminal.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So somebody accuses you and you get convicted, you could still only be sentenced to up to 5 years, even if during that interim period, new people getting convicted of that crime might be sentenced to 25 or life.
Right.
Or something
I totally understand that element of the law. I'm just questioning
like
whether the statute of limitations ought to be impacted by the ex post facto clause,
right.
And I don't believe, the answer is, Don, I don't believe that the statute of limitations would come into play here. because the ex post facto analysis applies to changing the penalty or making something a penalty that wasn't a crime.
Yeah, with all due respect, I still think that the California decision a couple of years ago, the court said that you cannot change the statute of limitations on somebody after either the crime has been committed or the original statute of limitations has been run.
Yeah. Well,
that's what I just said.
I'm not familiar with that particular decision, but I'm familiar with decisions that says that if the statute hasn't run, they can change it. You're not grandfathered into a statute of limitations, at least in New Mexico for sure. I know you're not, but if the statute has run, then they're SOL. They're shit out of luck.
Yeah.
So
okay.
So.
All right.
Move on to the rest of your queue.
Okay. What's next up, Larry?
So, well, we had additional state reports from people who were aware of things that they wanted to tell us, and then we're going to try to figure out how to get this collaboration going.
Figure out how we're going to do this.
Yeah, we're going to. Well, I'm not the organizer of all these fancy things. I'm just the one that dreams up the idea, and on all these callers here, we can come up with an idea how that we can collaborate more effectively than what we're already doing with the affiliates list, which I'm telling you up front, I will not post a lot of stuff on there that I would do legislatively. You'll have to talk to me if you want to know.
So this is an opportunity for those folks that had some other bills from their states that they're working on, and they would like to share those to press *6. Is that correct?
Yes.
All righty. So, Carlo and Richard, if you got things to say, it's time to hop back in here. If not, I'm going to unmute
you. Carlo went to the morgue.
She may have just hopped right on off there. There's some folks back.
Okay,
Scott,
hi.
You've got
Scott
more
again.
Bills?
Well, I was just going to make a little more mention of some of the bills that we're actually opposing. There's only five. So the first one is one that we've seen before. It's a bill that would require someone who loses his or her employment to register that employment, to register loss of employment. This was a direct result of an appellate court decision that the state lost. A district court found him guilty of violating the registration statute. He lost his job and didn't report it. And the appellate court ruled that loss of job does not equal
change of employment.
So therefore, therefore they want to close that little loophole or whatever. But this one passed the Senate in 2014, but it actually died in the House committee. Let's see, another one, the one that we've seen 4 years in a row now would make it illegal for a child sex offender to operate a taxi, limo, or a vehicle like an Uber or a Lyft. This is the fourth year in a row for that bill. I think it came off of some NBC Chicago report. Some Uber driver was charged with sexually assaulting a customer. However, I don't believe the Uber driver was on any registry, so go figure. There's a minor one I won't mention. Let's see. Then there's a new one that would create a library restriction where it's a very, very carefully tailored bill by the Speaker of the House. You can tell they put a lot of effort into making sure that there were provisions where if someone, so basically this is a library restriction bill where a child sex offender is prohibited from being present in a designated child or teen area of a library unless he or she is accompanied by his or her son or daughter. Seems to be an unnecessary law, but apparently there was an incident in one suburb of Chicago. I don't recall the details, but there was some incident at a library where some registrant did something inappropriate, I guess. Let's see. They want to create a new registry called the Career Offender Registration Act. I won't get into the details. It doesn't involve sex offenders or registered citizens. It's a new registry, so we just oppose any new registries. And then there's a second library bill similar to the first one, and this one doesn't have the provision to allow a parent to accompany his or her own child. So those are the only really bad bills we're tracking that involve registration and restrictions. It seems that the House Judiciary Committee is going to be very careful this session to allow in allowing any of these bills to go through, because right now the task force is meeting, and that was sort of the thing that the head of the committee brought up at this last committee meeting, that, we have this task force going on, and they're going to be talking about these things, and maybe that's the better place to bring this up instead of, filing a bill. So, and there are a few good ones. Won't really get into that, but there's going to be one of the good ones is juveniles on the registry will no longer need to pay the annual registration fee. That's a bill, $100 a year in Illinois. And there's also a bill creating the Job Opportunities for Qualified Applicants Act that would provide that any inquiries into a job applicant's criminal history may not inquire into events occurring more than 5 years before the date of the inquiry. And that would be even better than the California law, which I think has a seven-year provision in California. So that's all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have one other.
Little Rock, Arkansas. You're on the air.
I'm on the air.
Little Rock. You're on the, what is the name of that show over there? It could be you.
It could be you. And John's
plug,
even on the
you,
on the call,
John,
too. So,
John's
hey, John.
Not here.
I wanted to bring up at least three bills that we're looking at right now. One of them that I've already testified on. And thank goodness when one of the legislatures had a question, the only person that could answer it wasn't in the building, so they set the bill aside. It's asking for a sex offender's login and password to every social media thing that they could possibly log into. And we're fighting that one because they're already asking for, employment and your driver's license and your house and your boat and your airplane and, all kinds of stuff. And it's like, this is something else that they're wanting. So we're fighting
passwords
that one.
Passwords are going to be real problematic, Carla.
I know.
Yeah.
and I already told them about Utah, Nebraska, Georgia, and that North Carolina's got one going into the Supreme Court next week. I told them that. But while I was testifying, which just burnt me to no end. While I was testifying, they were sitting there playing with their phones and visiting with their neighbor and the whole bit. And I wanted to stop in mid-sentence and kind of go, I have the floor. Can you please at least look at me while I'm talking? But anyway, I'm not sure the outcome of this particular one, but we are fighting it. Another one that we've got is they're putting another 2,000 feet restriction on us. This will be for level threes and fours, which is supposed to be the top worst ones, where you can't live next to a mental or handicap facility, a group home type place. We had a guy not too long ago, I think it was last summer, that supposedly raped a mentally challenged girl. And he was already a registered sex offender, so that's where this one's coming from. So I want to ask, where do you want them to live? Because right now we're having such a problem with the guys can't even get out of prison right now because they have no home to go to. because they're basically having to live in tents out in the middle of the woods because there's no place they can go. That one hasn't come up yet. I'm hoping with all the emails that we've been sitting on that hopefully he's getting the message. The other one that we've got is it's pretty bad, but the guy who's got it, he's not a lawyer, and our lawyers have been talking to him, and again, he hasn't presented it yet. We're hoping he won't. It's written to where if you ever raped, if your crime was raped, then you're going to be on the registry for life. In Arkansas, you can petition to get off, you know, in 15 years. But this one's got it to where if you ever raped, then you're going to be on the registry for life. And even if you have gotten off the registry, this is going to put you back on the registry because you raped someone. So that one hasn't been presented yet, and we're hoping that it will never be presented. So that's the three bills that I'm looking at, plus some more, but that's the three that's got me worried.
So, okay. Thank you, Carla. The queue is filling up again, so I hope we can clear these really quickly because I wanted to get into some collaboration stuff here. So,
okay.
Richard, let's see how brief you can be.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a quick report. We've got a pretty active legislative session in New Hampshire this year. We have a House bill that required that prisons rehabilitation programs should best serve inmates and give them a chance to reduce their sentences. That died. A lot of our bills cover more than just sex offenders, but most of the time our bills are designed to help sex offenders as well, but we don't always mention them specifically. We had another bill, make the Department of Corrections seek to get all of its administrative rules approved by the Joint Legislative Rulemaking Committee. This bill has been retained. But we don't know what's going to happen with it at this point. Primarily, the Department of Corrections makes up its own rules, and nobody reviews them at this point in time. Another bill requires a judge to state the estimated financial cost of a sentence in the pre-sentencing report. And that died in committee, but the purpose of that was to tie a financial figure to a sentencing so that the state could start to see what its cost was going to be. Another bill expand the earned time law to let more prisoners win time off their sentences. The bill was retained for a work session, so again, we got to wait and see. Another bill let the Department of Corrections allow work release for prisoners and place them in a halfway house without a judge's approval. Right now in New Hampshire, in order to go to a halfway house for administrative release, it has to be approved by the sentencing judge. Another bill defined bodily injury and an assault as harm that caused permanent or protracted loss of health or function. The bill was amended to the federal law, which is harsher than the current law in New Hampshire. So that's going to probably be a loss. Make the jury charge more neutral for people accused of sex offenses. We had a case in New Hampshire last year where the prosecutor was basically calling the defendant a convicted sex offender before the conviction occurred. And he was able to do that under the state law. And I guess that's pretty much, I mean, there was a few other things, but that's pretty much. And by the way, that bill died in committee too. So those were the issues that we identified this year.
Thank you, Richard. I see Washington.
Yes, this is Washington. This is Jason in Washington.
You got to pronounce that R, Washington.
Oh, sorry. All right, so I don't know if everybody remembers Donna Zink in Washington, but she's the woman that requested a bunch of public records requests and was able to get everyone's name that was on the registry, including level ones, who are not publicly listed, only accessible through law enforcement only. And so now we have a new bill that is, it is Senate Bill 5578 concerning the release of sex offender information. And they basically are changing the statute to read, for offenders classified as risk level one, the agency shall add shall share information with other appropriate law enforcement agencies. And they're adding this line, and any individual who requests information. So basically anybody can request information on anybody in Washington now, even the privately listed people. So
it kind of defeats the purpose of the kind of like Arkansas. They did the same trick over there with Arkansas has the system where only the level threes and fours are on the internet, and then the sheriffs are releasing the list anyway. So that would Jason, if I'm correct, that would just make it where an entity could get the list and they could create their own disclosure of people who are on the registry. Apparently, right?
Yeah, and that's the argument we're trying to make. You know, so
okay,
that's all we have.
All right.
So,
hi, this is Cheryl again. Even though I'm in Missouri, my son is in Colorado, and so I'm familiar with what's going on in Colorado. Yesterday there were two Senate bills that were heard. I don't yet know what the result was, but the first one was to give judges the option to choose between a determinate or an indeterminate life sentence or a sentence for a sex offense. In 1998, the Colorado legislature passed the Lifetime Sentencing Act, which made it required for every felony sex offense that the judge had to say the sentence is so many years to life. My son is serving 4 years to life. So there's no way he could ever get out unless, well, yeah, the judge was not given an opportunity to decide between determinate and indeterminate. So this new bill is supposed to give the judges going forward this option to choose between the two, which is a good bill, I think. The other bill is related to allowing sex offenders who are in prison to complete their treatment outside of prison, after they get out of prison. And this is for economic reasons, because they're starting to realize how expensive this is to keep everybody in prison, just because they don't have enough treatment providers who are willing to travel to the distant locations where the prisons are located. So that's a good bill, too. Thank you.
So I like what I heard from Richard. I like what I heard from Cheryl. There's actually some things that could be helpful there. Didn't like what I heard from Seattle. Thanks, Jason.
Can't help that.
let's try to wrap these calls up quickly. John, it could be you. You're on the air.
Well, actually, he's not, but I can get both of them on. I got Cindy on.
A little correction. I don't think Carl mentioned in that one bill, rape by use of force is what would put the person on lifetime registration, and that it is, even in the wording of the bill itself, retroactive. So I just wanted to make sure that that little piece of information got added.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Hi, everybody.
Connecticut.
Hey, Cindy.
My turn.
Yep.
I just have a couple little questions. We've got a bill 6219, and it's sort of a baby bill. It needs development. But they want to incentivize corporations through tax credits to hire felons. And, of course, what I heard at the public hearing is, you know, not sex offenders. And I know Barbara Gale had mentioned that Georgia, effective January 1, 2017, started giving tax credits out to their companies. and I was wondering if there is any information as to whether sex offenders are in or out of that.
I tried to find that out. Andy, do you know anything about that? Because I did not find an exclusion.
Well, Andy's not unmuted. I'd have
He's
to...
Okay.
Okay, well, that's good then so far.
No, I haven't heard anything.
Okay, thank you. And then I have a question about something. You know, we don't have to be, of course, we're careful and we're watching the bills, but we also believe because of our special committee that nothing will get through right now because they're chartered through December of 2017. But my question is, one of the things they're looking at is putting level ones and twos law enforcement only. And that wouldn't hit the legislature until January of 2018, if then. So I'm thinking about, and be kind when you respond to this, I'm thinking about trying to get a temporary restraining order, an injunction of some kind, to see if we would possibly win it, that at some point this year that they stop putting people on a public registry. Because once you're out on the internet, we all know we can't retract it. And I'd like some feedback on that.
Oh. Yeah, I think I understand.
Do you have a particular person? Because I'll take a shot at it. Then.
Well, I figured you would, Larry.
Okay, well, as I have said to much chagrin, getting an injunction is a very difficult thing to do. Because you have to show that the law is unconstitutional in your initial pleadings. You have to be very convincing to show that you're likely to succeed on the merits, and that in addition, that irreparable harm will flow without the injunction. I'm not imagining that you're going to be able to get there because the U.S. Supreme Court decision that says internet release originates from the state of Connecticut. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that releasing people's information is okay. So I would have to think that I have to see your complaint. I'd have to see it drafted up and see what theories you're putting forward. But I would have to say that I would like to stop release of information that's already released, already in the public domain, in anticipation of a bill that we might be able to get through in 2018. Because harm is flowing, that is a pretty tall order.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara?
Yes?
Do you want to contradict or add?
Or encourage. Encouragement.
I tell you what, today is not a good day to ask me to be encouraging.
Well, Larry, how, if Connecticut's the state that... says it's okay, you know, for this internet release of information, how do we start fighting that? Like, what's the first step?
Well, you're talking about the first step. You're talking about a bill to change the law that would restrict internet release and not include the one level ones and twos. Now, I was not aware that you had a level system in Connecticut.
No, we don't. That's part of what's, you know, they think they're going to get two.
Oh, okay. Well, but to go...
Risk-based levels, either one and two or one, two, and three. There's been some talk about only having two levels.
Okay, so, but right now the law that's allowing release has been upheld by the highest tribunal in the land.
Mm-hmm.
So to seek an injunction against something that the highest court has declared to be okay, it would require some very creative lawyering.
Exactly.
And I know that's not what you would like to hear.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's a challenge. It's an opportunity. No, it's okay. I just wanted to ask that while we were on the phone call tonight. Thank you.
All right.
But yes, you're going about the right way. If you've got support building for people recognizing the damage that's being done by internet distribution. See, we didn't know all that. The case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided 14 years ago out of Connecticut, the internet wasn't nearly as widely used by employers and by apartments and landlords, and it's almost universally used by employers these days because of negligent hiring claims. We didn't know what we know now, and also the lawyering in those cases wasn't particularly good because they just threw their hands up and said, it's ex post facto, you can't do this after the fact. And they rested on the laurels of that this was something that wasn't available at the time that was sentenced, when the person was sentenced. And the Connecticut decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision out of Connecticut, they said, well, we're only releasing information that's already public. Well, that's not true. There's a lot of information being released on registries that was not a part of the original conviction. But that wasn't articulately put forward in the first case. So could you go back and argue, put forth a new case saying that releasing registry information, the broad amount that's released in most registries is more than just a conviction. I maintain that they could take your picture the day you're convicted, and they could take your conviction information, which is public in every state in the union unless it's been sealed by the court. They could take that information and they could put that on a website. And they could say, congratulations, you're on our sex offender registry. And if that's all they ever did, and you never had to report in, you never had to update anything, you never had to tell the state another thing about where you live and any more restrictions, I maintain that would be constitutional. Because we've all accepted a long time ago that your conviction or your mugshots, those are public information as adults. But that's not what registration was. But that was the way that the Connecticut case was argued. They said, well, court, don't get upset. This is just information about them that flows from the conviction. Well, it's not. It's where you work. That's not a part of your conviction. It's a whole lot of information on the website that's available that you must keep updated. So it's possible you could get a different outcome. But I'm not optimistic because our Supreme Court right now is moving in a direction that's probably not going to be favorable to our claims with the open seat and who's going to be on it. And that will, of course, make me unpopular with some people on the call, and I understand that. But
well, are we ready in the time? We're at almost 90 minutes, Larry.
Yes, we are. And I would like to figure out how we take all these dedicated people to get a NARSL collaboration going where we can work on legislative in a collaboration rather than just hoping that each state succeeds by themselves and say that a girl go you go Carla. I'd like to have Carla working with people that when we have common legislation like what we're dealing with statute of limitations to do our best to come. Now Illinois said that they don't take a position on some of these things. That's fine, but the states where you do take positions and you want to fight things, I think that a collaboration will be more effective than the states working by themselves.
Amen.
So
I would agree. So what is your suggested procedure right now, Larry, as far as this call goes and how we...
Well, I guess we would have to see some show of hands, though. It's going to require some organizational skills that I don't possess. I've not been very well at organizing the legal committee of lawyers that we've gotten that are willing to help us from time to time. So I think that someone's going to have to step up to the plate that also has a little bit of free time and a little organizational skills to try to figure out how to set up a collaboration. And it may require that we simply have a show of hands of people that are interested and we set up another meeting among those people. But I don't want this to end tonight, if at all possible. We've still got an overwhelming majority of the people that called in still here. So hopefully there's some interest in building a collaboration, a team collaboration here.
So a show of hands for people who could summarize that up real quick. What are we raising our hand?
And building a team of collaborators, and hopefully with that show of hands, we can figure out someone who might be willing to try to spearhead the organization. Because I'm not particularly good at building organizations. So I think we should have Jason do it.
I'm not seeing his hand just yet.
No,
Larry.
I'm seeing some hands, but I haven't seen his yet.
How do you do the hands?
You dial star six.
You did star six. You did it, Cindy.
You're already in here, Cindy.
Okay, can I make this one comment? When we left Atlanta, Georgia in September, that's where I thought we were going, that we were going to look for a national effort because, you know, as a new group, we need a little more direction. We don't have legal resources yet. We've got to go find, that's our biggest hindrance right now. But
yeah,
we would love to collaborate on something nationally. It would make a huge statement, and I think, Larry, that's exactly what we should be doing. So thank you, and I'm going to mute myself now.
Well, you're in the virtual hands. So there's the 1, 2, 3, 4 hands. And so I was hoping it would be a little more robust, but that's a start. You have to, the first, what is it, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So we can take these people here, and perhaps one of those might be willing to be a chair of a committee. And the people that were on this call tonight, we can certainly do a follow-up email. I haven't been as religious about doing follow-up emails, but we could certainly do a follow-up email and find out if any of you are interested and just didn't raise your hand, or people that have dropped might not know that we actually posed the question. So of the people that raised their hands, would anybody like to comment? We can hear from you about your ideas, because I'm open to suggestions. We've heard from Cindy. There's Don and James, Jimmy, and Scott.
Yeah, Larry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Larry? Yeah, this is Jimmy. I was already thinking about this for a while myself, as Cindy had said, trying to find a way to where we can get so many of these what I call sister groups to organize and work together instead of competing with each other. Because while we're on this call right now, tonight, having a conference call, trying to talk about how to lobby on these state bills, there is a competing call going on from another organization. The Women Against the Registry have timed their call for the same date and time. And I like to work with them, but I don't like the fact that they seem to constantly schedule their things. I almost feel intentionally sometimes. I'm not going to say that it is, but it feels that way at times, to compete against the other organizations, because some of the certain members' leadership's egos want to be the people in charge of everything. And we've got to find a way to overcome people's personal egos and desire to have to be the boss of everything and work together. Because I've seen people from other state groups that call in when we have calls like this for even Caution Click, and they get an argument going because there's a personality conflict, and then the people don't want to work together. And I'm thinking, this is a problem that we're not really talking about, and we're not dealing with, and it needs to be talked about and dealt with.
I would agree. I would love to have more communication and collaboration at that national level. It's difficult. We often have trouble just within NARSOL making sure that we don't overbook our committees on call nights. So some of the issue may be pure coincidence.
Sure.
Now, I've got rosy glasses, as Larry will tell you, but there's only 5 nights in a week, and we schedule hours sometimes kind of
well,
last.
Well, Jimmy, I'll say this. I don't have any connection to WAR. I'm not a member. I'm not on their mailing list. And I speak periodically with Vicki, but I was not aware of a call. I don't know if they had their schedule first or if we had ours scheduled first.
I don't either.
I just know that because I belong to both groups, plus I also belong to Caution Click, which they focus primarily on, child pornography cases,
mm-hmm.
whereas that, I even told the people on that call that we had this week earlier, because they do their calls on Monday, about this call, if they wanted to come in. But what was interesting is I got emails telling me about your call before I got the calls from the other group. And then it seemed like a day or two after your email went out, theirs went out, and it was real coincidental that it happened to be the same day. That's when I was like...
Yeah.
This is kind of irritating because I can't be on both calls at the same time, and I don't like being made to choose which call I'm going to take or group I'm going to support when I support multiple groups.
I will say that there's no spiteful action of scheduling. I burst people's bubbles, but I tell them that we have so few resources that we do so much we do so little watching other organizations because we've got our own hands full. So it never occurred to me to try to schedule around others, because I'm looking at a time for when we can do it and when
sure.
we can. You know, it's like my considerations are when we can do it, not when somebody else is having a call. Now maybe that's selfish, but we're looking at our own calendar when we schedule the calls, and usually we have guests that we have to consider, and I'm not really thinking about War or Axel or anybody else. I'm thinking about when we can do a call. Now, it's a good point, though, that
I thought that was the point. I thought that was one of the things that you were kind of addressing in this question that we're talking about right now, is to try to address that problem.
Well,
That's what I was understanding it as.
Yeah, what we're focusing on, I think, Larry, is correct me if I'm wrong, but the people raising their hands here, we're mainly focusing on
NARSL
creating a
collaboration.
NARSL. Yeah, people involved with NARSL. I realize there's people that, you know, maybe members of other organizations on the call. I know we have several. But the idea is just at a state level, people who are involved in, you know, legislation at their state level, and they want to collaborate with other state-level groups, and we want to try to help to, you know, build and coordinate those efforts when
right.
we've got things in common. So it's kind of along the lines of what you're talking about, but aimed more at state groups. You know, we have a number of those. So we have Don and Scott and Cindy and Jimmy. I don't know if the four of you are all wanting to be on a committee, or if you're just expressing your delight in the opportunity. But
yeah, this is Scott. Yeah, it would probably be good to share ideas on tracking bills and fighting bills. I think we could also come up with probably some common statements. We always like to say what our take is on the bill or what's wrong with the bill. And, you know, you oftentimes have to point to the same information. You know, you could even have a web page that, you know, all right, this is why residence restrictions don't work. And, you know, just, you know, that would be a good page to always point someone to from, you know, for a particular bill, or, you know, why presence restrictions don't work. And the same issues come up again and again. And then, you know, another thing I like to do is I like to track news stories. I track news stories, and also I like to know who's for the bill and who's against the bill. I watch the witness slips that are being filed each, you know, even if the bill's not being heard, the witness slips still get filed. So I know, for example, the Illinois ACLU is opposing the statute of limitations bills. To eliminate statute of limitations, their name is showing up consistently every meeting as in opposition. So, that's useful information.
Let you know who you can talk to.
Well, Brenda, you're the organizational guru. So when we wrap up here, let's leave with a plan of do we send another email to everybody was on this call and promoting the collaboration.
Larry?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, it's Cindy. I can't tell if I can talk or not. Am I unmuted?
Yes, you're on.
Okay, what you were talking about specifically, though, is that we're going to look for a legal challenge that we can all, you know, well, as many people as states would like to get involved in, that we're doing something sort of at the same time. I imagine there's a lot of economies of scale.
No. We're looking at common themes of legislation where the Victims Advocate Industrial Complex has come up with this abolition of the statute of limitations. This is being pushed by a number of entities around the country, the law enforcement and the victims' rights people. So rather than Carla trying to figure this out all by herself and you trying to figure it out all by yourself as a new relatively unseasoned advocate, if we could collaborate in figuring out, well, how do you fight this? I've got some ideas of how to fight it, and we're fighting it here in our state. But the collaboration I'm willing to do is not on that email list.
I thought when we left Atlanta, we were going to look for a legal challenge that we could do nationally.
We are looking for legal challenges, but we are not looking for a national legal challenge. There is no such thing. We're looking for what's called impact litigation, there is no national case that will end the registry, because the registry is a conglomeration of 50 registries. There's no national registry. But we are looking for cases. There are a number of cases pending that we're involved in. In North Carolina, there's more than one that we're involved in. In Rhode Island, to some extent, in Texas, so we're involved through our.
Well, as an example, though, post-incarceration checkoff of boxes, that's probably a very common problem. Okay,
yes.
Vermont won it.
Yeah.
To me, that would be something that if we had a group of states that wanted to do that, doing it together could be helpful.
Well, that legislation is pending around the country. As a matter of fact, there's a bill pending here, the ban the box type legislation. We're not fighting that through a challenge. If you're talking about, I'm not familiar with the Vermont case, but we legislative advocacy where there can be common arguments that are the same. And strategies that are the same. That's the collaboration we're trying to build here, so that you're helped along with strategy rather than having to invent it yourself.
What I was talking about Vermont is when you get out of prison, the probation boxes, you have 25 to 60 restrictions.
Uh-huh.
Vermont won the case because it was the judge said it had to be based on the offense, not indiscriminately checking off boxes. Like in Connecticut, you get out, you have all 60 restrictions.
Right.
Cindy? Yeah, Cindy, we're trying to focus on legislative.
No, I understand that now,
here.
But I was
okay.
Also, I mean, to me, I get the strategy, but to me, the legal challenge, having help with that would be more meaningful.
And we are doing that. We said in our strategic planning in Houston, we're going to try to identify three cases to get involved with, addition to what we're already involved with, that we'll have.
So we are working on that.
Yeah. So we are working on getting involved with cases. It's also a resource issue there. Our funding is very thin in terms of what we have available, and our volunteer attorneys are very thin. Litigation is very expensive and complex.
Whereas we could actually do quite a bit legislatively to prevent some of this stuff from happening in the first place, or amazingly enough, maybe even introduce something that's useful with some collaboration. And so that's what we're trying to focus on, this committee that we're trying to put together. So is this something that Scott, you, Don, James, are you all interested in helping with that, or
I'm interested. I'm not willing to take the lead on it.
Yeah, I don't want to take the lead on something right now. I've got a lot of other issues going on in my life to make a commitment like that. I just would like to see some type of organization. What I would think would help and benefit us is if groups would communicate amongst themselves and work together, especially when there's mutual causes. And, instead of just, focusing on
just a narrow group thing. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. And I think the plan then, Larry, sounds like we will send out a kind of a summary email at the end after this, so that everybody knows that we're trying to form this kind of a work group. And if there are others that might have already dropped or were too scared to raise their hands that would like to be involved in it, who to contact, and we'll try to get an extra organizational meeting together and decide where best to focus our resources, very limited resources.
And Barbara took a meticulous notes of this meeting, so.
You wrong did. Meeting, Larry.
Gee, Gail, and Barbara, I thought you were just, just here as an attorney answering attorney.
That
questions.
Was what I was. Thank you very much, Brenda.
You're welcome. Anytime.
This was actually recorded, so we have the notes if we want to refer back to the recording. So I think we're going to end. Did you want to promote your conference call coming up Tuesday, Brenda? I always ask you that, and you say, huh?
Huh? Yeah, we definitely have one coming up next week, and everybody should have just gotten something in the email about it. I saw it pop up as I was getting on this call, so it's coming up on Tuesday. And we're going to be hearing from another state, Florida, on some of the strategies that they've been using to recruit, if I'm remembering correctly. And so tips and tricks on recruiting to build your membership and how they've been doing it and how that's worked for them. So I hope
can't
you
wait.
All...
That's going to be good.
Okay, I know a lot. That's another thing that a lot of state groups are really kind of struggle with is, you know, how do you get people involved and add members and get them paying dues and, you know, things like that. So I'm hoping to learn all about that on Tuesday.
So, and I guess we're going to turn off the recording, conclude this edition of NARSL in Action.